The following is intended solely for the use of those with a sense of adventure.
I'm shaking the dust of this town off my feet, and I'm going to see the world.
This is Travel with Hawkeye. Here's your host, Mark Hawkeye Lewis.
Welcome to this week's podcast. It's the podcast of two Bs, baseball and bicycling. First of all, baseball. I'm a big fan of baseball, big fan of travel, and we're going to talk a little baseball, a little bit of traveling with Eric Nadel, who is the Hall of Fame broadcaster for the Texas Rangers, and he gets to travel for work and goes to cities all over America. And I thought, what a better person to talk to about some of his favorite places in the United States and what to see and do there and where to eat than Eric Nadel, who's been doing it for 30 plus years for the Rangers. And then also on the show, this is something I really kind of never really planned on doing, but I thought, hey, why not? Got an email from a listener by the name of Susie Vandiver, and she said, hey, you should do a story about people who cycle on some of these rails to trails across America, and that's their vacation. And I thought, okay, why don't you come on and talk about that, since you probably know more about it than most people, since you've done that on your vacation and kind of tell people about it and how you did it. And so she's going to join us on the latter half of this podcast. And so I'm going to make this invitation. If you've taken a unique vacation, you've tried a unique traveling experience, and you'd like to share it with others, contact me. Go to our website, travelwithhawkeye.net. Tell me about it, and we may use you on the podcast. You can also find me on social media. I'm on Twitter, at Hawkeye On Air, Instagram, Facebook, at Hawkeye On Air. You can find me there, and I would love to hear from you. I'd always love, you know what? Always love feedback about the show, about things we should talk about. And if you're an expert on something, that's a great way to contact me. The best way, though, is on our website, travelwithhawkeye.net. You can reach us via email. But I want to start off with Eric Nadel. As I said, a member of the Baseball Hall of Fame, the broadcast division there, a longtime broadcaster for the Texas Rangers. I even had a chance actually to do the pregame show a few times, fill in, and I thoroughly enjoyed that. And Eric, welcome to the podcast.
How you doing, Hawkeye?
We are doing awesome. And as I said to you off the air, you are my dream guest because, one, I know you're well-traveled, but also you're one of the few people that also travel for work, and you're on the road probably over 100 days a year. Is that about accurate?
Yeah, I figure including spring training, it's about 120 nights just in doing the Rangers job and then whatever optional travel I choose during the off season.
Well, let's talk a little bit about first your travel for work, because you get to travel to some of the best cities in the United States. And I'm sure you have your favorites. You see them on the schedule and you're thinking to yourself, I can't wait to go to this city. I've actually put three down here as my guess, but I want to hear what your three favorite cities to travel to.
Okay, well, keep in mind, I grew up in New York City and consider myself to be an escapee from New York City.
Oh, okay, so, okay.
I am really a Western guy when it comes to cities to travel to. And in the American League, my two favorites by far are San Francisco, which is where we stay when we play Oakland, and Seattle.
Oh, really?
To me, they're very similar cities. Seattle is, you know, a little more rural, not quite as crowded version of San Francisco, but it has the hills, it has the water, mm-hmm. it has the great ethnic restaurants, and a multicultural population.
And what does Eric Nadel like to do when he goes to San Francisco and Seattle?
Well, I like to walk a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I get out, I walk down by the water usually. Sometimes I'll just walk through neighborhoods. I put a lot of miles in those cities. The weather's usually very mild there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it's a little cool, we certainly don't mind it getting out of the Texas summers. And then I have, you know, by now I have several favorite restaurants, you know, in all of these cities. I figure, you know, since we go to those cities three times a year, I spend 9 or 10 days every year in those cities.
Yeah.
I've been going for 33 years, so I've probably spent the better part of a year of my life in each of those two cities. So I have a lot of favorite restaurants, but I keep uncovering new ones.
Give us one of your favorite restaurants in Seattle that may be a little bit off the beaten path for people who like to travel up there.
Off the beaten path. Well, you know, there's all those seafood restaurants that are down by the water.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that I think most people don't realize is there's a real art to making and cooking Dungeness crabs and eating Dungeness crabs. And the best place by far down there is a place called Elliot's. It's right on the water. It's near the ferry terminal. And most people go in there and, you know, they order some kind of fish, or everybody orders salmon when they go to Seattle. But the thing to do is to go to Elliot's and get the Dungeness crab with a variety of sauces. they serve it with. I prefer it cold. You can also get it hot. There's also a place there called Ivar's, and it's a salmon house, and they have several locations, but there's one specific location that I enjoy, which is over near the University of Washington. It's on Lake Union, and that's the Ivar's Salmon House that I really like. They have a really nice smoked salmon over there. And one other thing I would tell people when they go to Seattle, if you've never had halibut cheeks, it's worth calling around to the seafood restaurants to see if they have them.
They're, did you say halibut cheeks?
Cheeks. They are the facial cheeks of the halibut.
Uh-huh.
They come in short supply. You can actually buy them at the public market down there, but some restaurants will have them. Some restaurants don't have them. The restaurant that almost always does is McCormick's, which is a Seattle institution, which is right downtown.
Okay. And in San Francisco, where are some places that you like to dine in San Francisco?
Well, San Francisco, I am an absolute addict for a place called Henry's Hunan. They have four or five restaurants scattered around the city, most of them not too far from downtown. It is very, very spicy Hunan Sichuan food.
Okay.
And I eat a ton of Chinese food all over the country. Nowhere do they make the sauces taste like they do at Henry's Hunan. They just have a unique recipe. They somehow ferment the peppers and the black beans, and just make sure you find a Henry's Hunan. And I'll actually go there sometimes on a 3 or 4 day weekend. I'll have 3 or 4 meals there.
Really?
And I will bring Tupperware there and order things to go and take them to the ballpark so I can have my meals at the ballpark, Henry's Takeout.
That is hilarious. We're talking to Eric Nadel, longtime voice for the Texas Rangers. I have to tell you, the three cities I wrote down were not included on your list of your favorites. One was New York City, and you told us why. But the other two, and taking a guess, I thought would be possibly Toronto and Chicago.
I love both those cities.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Chicago probably would have been third on my list, I think.
Okay.
It's so vibrant downtown there. It has a different feel to me than any of the downtowns. There, too, there's so many restaurants, you can't possibly cover them all. Walking along the lake is great.
Yeah.
And Toronto is amazing for its international nature and the fact that you feel totally safe there no matter what time of night you're walking. And in all these places, too, I love finding live music. And in all these places that we've mentioned, it's pretty easy to find live music any night of the week.
Touch on a little bit about why you feel so safe in Toronto.
I'm not sure what it is. I don't know whether, you know, there's a big police presence because you don't see it there, or if it's just something about the nature of the population. But I just have never felt threatened, never heard of anyone there and all the travels from all the baseball teams that I know, anyone having any sort of a criminal situation come up in Toronto. It's something about Canada, I think. You know, I don't know if it's because they have stricter gun laws or because, you know, they are a little more of a socially liberal society. I really don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But it does have a different feel to it.
And let me ask you this. When teams come to play the Rangers, they normally stay in Arlington. Is that not correct?
Not anymore.
Oh, really?
They tend to move around every couple of years because fans find them.
Oh, I see.
So they're like the Beatles.
Okay.
They have to keep moving hotels or else there'll be hundreds of people, you know, waiting outside the hotel when they arrive.
But do you ever hear from teams that say, you know what, we don't really get a vibrant street life when we stay in the Dallas-Fort Worth area because we're kind of out in the middle of nowhere?
Yeah, definitely, especially when they used to stay out by the ballpark,
mm-hmm.
you know, either at the Arlington or the Sheraton there. Some teams started moving over to Fort Worth, Worthington,
mm-hmm.
and those guys really like it. You know, they have Sundance Square right
yeah.
there, and that's a very popular site. And, you know, more and more teams are staying farther out from the stadiums if it gives the players some things to do away from the ballpark. You're seeing that in more cities than just Dallas-Fort Worth.
We're talking with Eric Nadel, longtime broadcaster for the Texas Rangers. When the season's over, I know you're an avid traveler, which is, some might think, well, you know, you'd want to stay home a little bit, but I know you like to get out and see parts of the world. You've been to Chile, the Dominican Republic, Venezuela, Puerto Rico, Mexico. Trips have to do with baseball, or do you try to get as far away from baseball as possible?
Well, the first trip we take when the season ends is usually to Colorado.
Uh-huh.
And I take my wife, Jeannie, and our dog, Nemo, and we head to Colorado and we rent a house in the mountains and we stay for a couple of weeks and someone comes over here and stays in our house and takes care of our house in Dallas. So we are not concerned with you know, how long we stay, when we come back. And we go hiking every day.
Mm-hmm.
We do day hikes and we'll usually pack a lunch and hike up to a beautiful mountain lake or the top of a mountain, a beautiful view. And we do that every day. And then we come back and we sit in the hot tub and we watch the sunset. And we've been in all different locations of Colorado. Our current favorite is Nederland, which is a little town that's about half an hour west of Boulder, just up in the foothills on the Peak to Peak Highway. Very non-commercialized. But I love Steamboat Springs. I love Telluride. And we try and get there before the big snows come. But Costa Rica has always been a big outdoor adventure place for us. We've gone whitewater rafting there. You know, we've done beach exploring there. And some of the other trips are baseball-related. In Venezuela, I went to Caracas, stayed for 2 weeks, and went to Spanish language school.
Mm-hmm.
And then went to baseball games during their winter league. I've done the same thing in the Dominican Republic a couple of times, and in Puerto Rico. I've also seen winter league games in Mexico, down in Mazatlan and Hermosillo. So the trips to Latin America for me are educational because I'm constantly trying to improve my Spanish. But I generally tend to favor places always where I can spend a lot of time outdoors.
Eric Nadel, longtime broadcast for the Texas Rangers. Some tips for those who like to travel throughout the U.S. And if you could pick just one, on a closing note, if you just pick one city with the ballpark experience, where would you choose?
Well, for the ballpark experience, you still have to say Fenway Park.
Okay.
And Boston, if you've never been to it, and I grew up in New York and went to college in New England, so it's no big deal for me now. But if you've never experienced Boston, you've never experienced Fenway, I would say that would be the must-see. It looks a little more like a modern park, but not totally. And if you've never been there and you don't realize, you know, that they've added seats above the Green Monster, mm-hmm. and seats on the roof, it's still, you know, it's obvious this place was built in 1912.
Yeah. Eric Nadel, thank you very much for your time today.
It's a pleasure.
And we will continue to tune you in on the Texas Ranger broadcast.
Thanks, and come join us on the road anytime.
I will have to take you up on that offer sometime. Eric Nadel from the Texas Rangers, Hall of Fame broadcaster. And speaking of baseball, just a couple things of note baseball-wise. If you're a traveler and a historian and you like the sport of baseball, baseball is an interesting sport in the fact that a lot of fans have on their bucket list of life to visit every Major League Baseball park. I don't really know of another sport that really does that. Maybe, to be honest, maybe a little bit of college football. A lot of people maybe want to visit every football stadium in their college football conference. But you don't hear a lot of people saying, you know, I really want to go to Ford Field in Detroit. But you do hear people say, I want to travel and visit every baseball stadium in America. And, you know, that's kind of not a real bucket list item of mine. But I do try to make as many games as possible. And I've been to many, many stadiums across the U.S. And I've also been to a lot of stadiums that no longer exist, like the original Tiger Stadium, the middle Yankee Stadium. There's actually three different versions of it. Been there, been to the Astrodome. That no longer exists. Been to the King Dome. Been to Busch Stadium, the circular stadium that they used to have. I've been to that one. I've been to Arlington Stadium, where the Texas Rangers play. Those all don't exist anymore. Quite a collection of stadiums that do not exist. And I'm a fan of old baseball stadiums along with the current parks. I love what they've done with the current parks. But I've kind of become a bit of a history buff when it comes to old baseball stadiums. And I've always liked to find remnants of places where people used to play baseball, what's left of them. And so I've kind of added, and you can go to our blog. I've got a blog post on this, and you can find our blog via travelwithhawkeye.net. So if you're inclined, like me, to kind of find remnants of old baseball stadiums, I kind of have a list of some things that are still in existence from old baseball stadiums. Now, first of all, Yankee Stadium. When they built the current edition of Yankee Stadium, they built it across the street from the old Yankee Stadium. And the field they retained for a city park. And the same is true in Tiger Stadium in Detroit. The Police Athletic League bought the old site for Tiger Stadium, and they use that as athletic facility. So part of that field still exists. But one of my favorite places, and I haven't got a chance to visit this yet, what a city has done is in Cleveland. Cleveland had a stadium called League Park, and they vacated it in 1947 to move to Cleveland Municipal Stadium. The interesting thing about League Park, and I've never heard of this actually happening for another team, but The Indians actually played in League Park, which was a smaller stadium, during the weekdays. And on the weekends, they would play in Municipal Stadium, which sat like over 60,000. And they left League Park in 1947, tore most of it down. But there was a little bit left. There was a ticket office that was left, which is down the right field line. And there was a bit of the original wall. And then it just, the lot kind of sat there vacant with a plaque there for many, many years. And then just a matter of years ago, I think it was 2013, the city of Cleveland decided to renovate the old ticket office, also restabilize the wall, which is down the outer wall of the stadium on the right field side, and then make a baseball park, a baseball stadium, following the original dimensions of the field. And they did a really great job of that and made a park of the whole site. And it's now called League Park. And you can find that in Cleveland. And nice, they did a nice job. And they use the field now for high school games. And they actually have field turf on it, so it's really easy to maintain. But it has the same dimensions as the original League Park. And it's one of the most faithful reconstructions of an old field. Not the stadium stands, of course. They don't need all the stands for high school games and amateur games. But they did a nice job on the field. That's in Cleveland. That's one of my favorite ones. I haven't got a chance to visit it, but I've done a lot of research on it. Also, another bit of baseball history that still exists is the original field for the Boston Braves. Now, if you're a fan of Major League Baseball, you know that the Atlanta Braves played in Milwaukee before they came to Atlanta. And before that, they played in Boston. And they left Boston in 1952. And when they left, Braves Field, or sometimes known as the Wigwam, was sold to Boston University. Now, coincidentally, it's not that far from Fenway Park. It's actually walking distance from Fenway Park. These two stadiums were very, very close. And so Boston University bought Braves Stadium, and they still own it to this day. Now, they've done some massive renovations, and really all that's left are two things. The field is still there, but they use it now for track and lacrosse and soccer and events like graduation. But the bleachers down the right field line are still in existence. And they say if you go underneath the bleachers, it looks exactly like it did after the Braves left in 1952. So those bleachers down the right field line are still there. And also, the ticket office for Braves Field in Boston is still there. And it's right in front of the bleachers that are left, and that is now the Boston University Police Department. So if you are on campus and you see the police department, that's the old ticket office for Braves Field, and then right behind it, you'll see what's left of Braves Field, now called Nickerson Field. And then also, this is one of the one of my favorite things also, it's in New York City, is what's left of the Polo Grounds. Now, the Polo Grounds is where the New York Giants played until they moved to San Francisco in the late 50s. And the stadium actually was a very odd stadium, and it had really weird dimensions. It was really, really deep in center field. In fact, if you've ever seen that over-the-shoulder catch that Willie Mays made, it's because the Polo Grounds were so deep in center field. It was like well over a 450. The odd thing is, it was very narrow down the left and right field line. It was like 275. It was just a very odd-shaped field. So after the Giants left, the Polo Grounds remained, and it was the first home of the New York Mets and also the first home of the New York Jets until they built Shea Stadium in Queens. And then they ended up tearing down the Polo Grounds, and there's a housing project there now dubbed Polo Ground Towers. It's like public housing. Now, the Polo Grounds were actually on the northern end of Manhattan, not far from Yankee Stadium. In fact, the Harlem River is what separates the Bronx and Manhattan. And just on the other side of the river is Yankee Stadium. They're very, very close. And the Polo Grounds was also at the bottom of a big hill called Coogan's Bluff. And one time, the owner of the New York Giants, John T. Brush, got tired of fans who would just stand on the top of Coogan's Bluff and look into the stadium and watch the game for free. So he built a stairway down so one fans might come down the stairway, and it ended right at a ticket office for the Polo Grounds. And also for fans who lived on top of the Bluff who were going to buy tickets anyway, they didn't have to walk all the way around. They could just walk down the staircase. Well, years after the Polo Grounds were torn down, the staircase remained. And it even had a plaque on, or not plaque, actually a cement landing area that said a gift from the New York Giants and John T. Brush. But the stairs kind of fell into disrepair, and there was brush over it, and nobody ever took them anymore because they're so dangerous. So the city of New York, they decided to renovate the park, and they wanted to renovate the staircase. And they got funds. This is oddly enough, they got funds to renovate this staircase that allows you access to the old Polo Grounds from the Mets, the Yankees, the New York Football Giants, the New York Jets, and the San Francisco Giants. They all donated funds to renovate this old staircase. So if you go to Manhattan, it's on the very northern end. It's in an area just south of the Bronx, like at the edge of Harlem. I think it's called Morningside Heights. I think George Carlin actually lived in that area at one time. You're almost up to where Columbia University is. You can still find the staircase that allowed fans to enter the Polo Grounds, called the John T. Brush Stairway. So that is still there also. If you're a fan of baseball, search that out. And then one more piece of baseball history that still exists is Colt Stadium. And you may not be familiar with Colt Stadium. A lot of people are familiar with the Astrodome. That was the first home of the Houston Astros. But before they were named the Astros, while they were building the Astrodome, they were called the Houston Colt 45s. And they built a makeshift stadium in the parking lot of what is now the Astrodome called Colt Stadium. So while the Houston Colt 45s were preparing for their new indoor dome stadium to be built, and they could see it just beyond the outfield bleachers there, they played in this makeshift stadium. When they moved to the Astrodome, they changed their name from the Colt 45s to the Houston Astros. That stadium, they sold the entire stadium, and it moved to Mexico. It moved, and a team in Mexico took the old Colt Stadium that was once a place where the Yankees played. Well, the Yankees played an exhibition game there, but once a place where, you know, the National League Houston Astros then at that time played. And the entire stadium moved to Mexico and ended up in two different cities. The stadium was moved twice, and it ended up in Tampico. And it was actually bought to be moved a third time, but Tampico is on the Gulf of Mexico, and it's just a very humid climate, pretty much destroyed the stadium. And it was pretty old at that time. So some of the bleachers from that stadium actually remained and were moved to Mexico City for a stadium in Mexico City. But for the most part, the Colt Stadium is a little bit left here and there. But that's another stadium that still exists in small little pieces. So just once again, I'm a fan of baseball and a fan of history. And if you look every now and then, you could find just a little bit of remnants of some historic stadiums. As I mentioned earlier in the podcast, I got an email from Susie Vandiver who said, "Hey, you should do a story about what we did on vacation." And I said, "You know what? That's a great idea. Why don't you be the guest and tell us about it? Because you probably know more about it than anybody." So, first of all, Susie, thank you so much for reaching out to us.
Sure. Not a problem. It was a good show, and I enjoy listening to people talk about where they've been and what they've been doing as far as travel is concerned.
Well, and in your email, you wrote me about a vacation that you recently took, and it's something I'd never heard about before, and I wanted you to share it with everybody else because it sounded like just a great time. So first of all, tell us just a real quick synopsis before we delve into what you did on your vacation.
My husband and I have cycled for probably 10 years, and we did it just to stay fit. But we had always thought it would be fun to travel by bike. But when we investigated, we found that most of the places you had to be on the road, which kind of is scary if you've ever cycled much, because cars are not always the friendliest things to share the road with. So we started looking around, and we found where you can cycle on old railroad beds. They have taken them up. It's called Rails to Trails.
Mm-hmm.
And they take these old,
railroad tracks, where the railroad tracks went, yes.
The railroad tracks. They take those up, and then they put basically crushed granite down and make a trail that goes where the railroad, the train used to go. And what's so nice is the grade is only about 2%.
Yeah.
And so it's not, you don't have real tall mountains to go through, or now you go through the mountains, but they have graded it to where it's, the train could do it.
Yes, yeah.
And so it makes it easy to bike, and it's just great. It goes, we've taken two different vacations that are just purely cycling, And then we did another one last year where we went up to Idaho and did the Hiawatha Trail.
Now, let me just ask you a few questions. Okay, first of all, a lot of people around here are familiar with a rail-to-trail that's known as the Katy Trail in Dallas. They also have the Cottonwood Trail and the Santa Fe Trail. Those are in urban areas, and people use them as running paths. And
Now, there's also one in Weatherford that goes to Mineral Well.
Yes, but now you went on one that actually went through a couple different states, correct?
Right. Well, no, they didn't go through. It was one state. We went in Wisconsin, and then we went in Missouri.
Oh, okay.
It stayed in Missouri, and then it stayed in Wisconsin. So we did two different. Vacations.
Okay. Now, but both these vacations, they were multiple day vacations?
Yes, they were. They were usually four days and five nights and five nights.
Okay.
But they were four continuous days of cycling.
Okay. And the neat thing about that you wrote, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that I don't know if you hired a service or it was part of a vacation plan, but basically you just got on your bike and rode, and at the end of the day, your accommodations and your equipment, your suitcase, were transferred from one city to the next? Is that how it worked?
Uh-huh. We usually went anywhere from 30 to 40 miles a day, and you would just go to another small town in, say, Missouri or Wisconsin. And while you are biking, we went through a man that has a company called Independent Tourist, and he has several different biking tours that you can take. And he has contracted with different bed and breakfasts that you stay at. And then you just get your suitcases and everything together and leave it with the bed and breakfast, and they somehow either the innkeeper or they contract with somebody else to take your suitcases and stuff to your next location. And all you have to do is cycle on this path, find the location, which it all is just all mapped out for you. It's very good. Mm-hmm. And you just have to find the location. When you get there, all your suitcases are there, and you're ready to spend the night.
So we're talking with Susie Vandiver, who just listens to the show. She sent me an email about a vacation that she took, and it's called Independent Tourist. Is that the man's business? Because I want to find his website. I'm going to link it to our website.
Okay.
So you did a couple different trips here. Now let me ask you this: your level of cycle. You said earlier that you do cycle a lot, but I mean, are you like Lance Armstrong kind of cyclist or recreational?
No. We're recreational. We cycle for charity rides, and we cycle for the Trinity Trail. We may go out to Benbrook and go around the lake, and that's we just cycle to stay fit and because we like it. And no, we're not Lance Armstrong, climb the mountains. In fact, we try and that's hard on our bodies.
Okay.
And we don't. And when working, we don't have the ability to train like that, to be able to cycle like that.
Would you say that 30 to 40 miles a day, that would be the distance that someone who's in, that is a reasonable distance to tackle every day? It's not something you have to be super in shape for?
It's something you'd want to, get on your bike a couple of, weeks before and to be able to do it, mainly because of sitting that long.
Yes, the bicycle seat.
On the bicycle seat.
Yeah.
But really and truly, you go through small towns just like the train would, and they have you eat lunch, you get off. It took us longer to get. You think 30 or 40 miles? I can do that probably in a good 4 hours.
Okay.
I can do it 10 miles an hour.
And that's a very easy pace, 10 miles an hour on a bike.
But it would take us all day to get there because we would stop and take pictures. We would stop and eat lunch. We would stop and see the little towns that we went through. So it literally would take us all day to get through.
And you're on vacation.
We were on vacation. Yeah. We weren't trying to kill ourselves to get through. But one, and I know in off the Katy Trail, there's another trail that goes up to Columbia. We went up there, and that's a real nice little town. And it you just have all these little wineries you can go to and all these other little things that you can do that's off the trail. And we loved it. We just had the best time.
And
would do it again.
I am going to link the website that you talked about, Independent Tourist, so people can find out more about these trips and how to have your accommodations taken care of and everything planned out. Now, did you bring your own bike or did you?
We did. And we prefer to do that. We have a truck, and so we put our bikes, which is a hybrid type bike. We saw other people on there that they're on their road bikes, which are you're able to do on a road bike. But a hybrid bike has a little bit wider tire.
Mm-hmm.
And we took our own bikes just because we like our seats.
Yeah.
we like our bikes that are fitted to us.
Okay.
And the places we stayed were very accommodating to cyclists. They always had some place to lock your bike up at night. They always had a place to, you know, a pump to air your tires up in the morning. And they were just very accommodating. And in Wisconsin, we found that the little towns that we went through have really re-energized because the cyclers that come by and have kind of just re-energized the towns that,
yeah,
once the railroad was not there anymore, almost died out. And it's just going through the tunnels, especially in Wisconsin, there were three tunnels
through. Because that's another thing in the letter, and you sent pictures. And this is sounding pretty neat because this trail that you went on, a former rail line.
Right.
We're talking with Susie Vandiver, who's one of our listeners who wrote me about a vacation she took. And these rail lines go through some of these tunnels. And so did you ride your bike through tunnels? Because the sign said you had to walk your bike.
Oh, you saw that sign.
Yeah.
Okay, yes. You are supposed to walk your bike through that tunnel, and I did not. I did not.
But I
wanted
know.
To. But one of the tunnels is almost a mile long. You could not see the end of it. Literally, it was so dark you could not see
did
the end of it.
Did you have a light, or how did you go through?
Oh, yes, we had a very bright. We had very bright lights specifically bought to go, and a flashing light on the back of it.
Okay.
But it was in the inside the tunnels. There are kind of gutters that hold water because this drips water year round.
Yeah.
It's so cold in there. But the long tunnel was very, very claustrophobic to me because it was just – and I stayed right on my husband's tire. I mean, I did not let him get out. But the other ones are not so bad because you can see the end of it. But it was just very interesting to learn the history of these tunnels and how they have to – and they even close the doors during the snow now so they don't let the snow in because it will disintegrate the limestone that's inside the tunnels. But the one of the things up in Wisconsin they also do on this trail is they snowmobile during the winter.
Okay. Yeah.
So they also you can also winter up there and you can't go through the tunnels, but they have routes onto people's private property that they have allowed them for the snowmobiles to go around.
Well, very interesting.
So it's very and what's so nice about the one in Idaho is not only were there tunnels, I think there were like 9 tunnels we went through, there are, what are they called? They were so high up in the mountains, you had to go across, I'm sorry, my brain has just gone blank. They're just very, very high, and they're trails that had to connect mountains together.
Uh-huh.
And you had to go across. It's called the Hiawatha Trail, if you want to look that one up and post some of the pictures from that. But it was just very interesting but it was just a one-day trip. It wasn't a true vacation, as I call it, that's on your bike.
I tell you what, it's so interesting because this is a totally different kind of vacation. My wife and I were talking about this last night after we got your email, and I thought, you know what, this is something we'd like to do. And you know, once again, you don't have to be a big-time cyclist.
No.
You do do some recreational cycling. You if you cycle 10 miles an hour, I mean,
very easy to do.
Yeah, and it sounds like of any age group can accomplish this. You could have families go on this. And once again, the website, the man's business was called Independent Tourists.
Yes, Independent Tourists. And then you can also look up the Rails to Trails Conservatory. They're the people that are helping conserve these these train tracks to be able to be made into trails. And like I told you in my email, we're planning on doing one up in that's basically the Allegheny Pass trail up in Pennsylvania, and it connects Pittsburgh to
Pennsylvania? I mean to Philadelphia?
It connects it to Washington D.C.
Wow.
That's how far it goes. Yeah. And that they're so proud of their trail because now you can literally get off of the plane in Pittsburgh and within a couple of blocks get on the trail and go all the way to Washington, D.C.
Wow, that is fantastic. And once again, when you get out of some of these towns, too, you're not on a road. You're on a rail line, so there's not gas stations and billboards. You're out in the country, too, I bet.
You're out in the country. You're out in the—sometimes, I know in Missouri, sometimes you go through cornfields.
Wow.
Then sometimes you would go through canopied trees. And you have other metal and steel and wood bridges to have to go over because there were so many streams and rivers to go over. And it just it's just one of the best vacations we've ever taken.
Well, thank you so much, Susie, for joining us today. And what's the thing I tell people all the time when you travel?
Always bring your swimsuit.
Yes. See, I know I didn't like your attitude there. You seemed like you weren't enthusiastic about your swimsuit. You never know when you got an opportunity to swim, Susie.
I know, but I don't always bring my swimsuit, not on my bike, but I wear spandex.
Susie, thank you so much for joining us. Hey, that was awesome. I'm glad that you've shared that with listeners. I'm sure you've given a lot of people something to check out.
I hope so. I hope a lot of people do it. It's a lot of fun.
All right. And you know what? Once again, if you're listening to this and go, you know, I've been on a kind of unique vacation, I'd like to share that with people, then contact me, travelwithhawkeye.net. There's a contact section there. You can also contact me on social media. I would love to hear from you and love to hear any comments you have on the show. Thanks to Eric Nadel, Texas Rangers Hall of Fame broadcaster, for his look at some of the different cities in the U.S. around Major League Baseball, and Susie Vandiver for contacting us and being part of our podcast. And remember, the world is out there. Your adventure awaits. I'm Mark Hawkeye Lewis, and this is Travel with Hawkeye.